Tonight starts the first class in a series of 10 classes, I think, on contemplating death and dying. I'm not sure how many classes. I'm going to watch and see how you relate to this and whether I'm giving you too much too quickly. It's really a class series in which you have to monitor yourself very carefully. I love this subject, so I'm really in my element, but that's kind of weird. So I can get too effusive and passionate about it, and I can. So I want to temper my own delivery, and I also want to monitor your receptivity to this, and I encourage you to self-monitor as well. If the subject doesn't resonate, that's fine. You're still welcome to come. But if there's a lot of fear and grief, which you can arouse, especially because we're going to do as many weeks as this class series goes, we're going to do contemplation on death and dying. That's going to be the focus of what we do. It's not going to be so much a talk about seeing through death, or some of that will arise, but mostly it's going to be just holding the subject. And working with the subject on an ongoing basis, but everyone who works with the subject is affected by it. In hospice care, even the secretaries who never went out and saw anybody were affected by the aura, by the orbit of the subject. In fact, I wasn't joking when I suggested that we feel the camaraderie of each other. That camaraderie offers a sense of solace in the face of the subject. The subject, if it has any impact, it's usually one of the impacts it has is on an isolating, a sense of isolation and despair and loneliness and being cut off from, which is often what death represents to those of us who don't understand it. So in hospice care, we gather around the interdisciplinary team and then speak from the humanness of the response in the circle of people, keeping the patient in the center of our focus, but knowing that all of us were in this together, and we're offering each other the support that all of us needed to face not the patient, but the subject. You see, It's the patient was never the problem. It was always the subject of death and dying. And if you lost your care within the patient and forgot the subject behind that, it was to the detriment. You wouldn't be as effective, nor would you grow as much. And if you lost the subject within the patient, or the patient within the subject, either way, if you lost that figure ground, something was missing, you could feel it. But what it did for me was it invited a way to hold humanity and at the same time from the personal and the impersonal, because death is a very personal subject to each one of us, because each one of us are going to have to go through it. At the same time, it's completely impersonal. It's not just, they're not just picking you out of the group. But if you get too caught up in either side of that, you can lose the edge from which that growth occurs. I remember when I was in graduate school, I was getting a master's in working with this subject, really. It was a master's in social work, but there were courses I was taking on death and dying, and I felt a very at-ease feeling around the subject from an intellectual perspective, the knowledge, the very impersonal knowledge of it. But then the rooming house where I was staying, the woman who owned it started to caught terminal cancer, was going through the phases of her death, and of course she was reaching out for someone to speak to. It was before the days of hospices. And because I was doing that very thing in school, she thought I would be the perfect person to lean on for support. And what I tried to do was just run away. I tried to avoid her. I tried to get out of the house as quickly as I could, because it became too... It was fine when it was textbook. When it became... When the bite began to be felt, then the fear was too much for me. And I have regretted that all my years. But it was the only thing I could do, given where I was at that time, my early 20s. So I offer you that. I want to make sure that each of us self-monitor and not try to be too harsh with this topic. It really needs a lot of tenderness within us. So this question of death and dying... The Buddha talked about it. He talked about it a lot. And in fact, on the website, I have the Marana Sati Sutta, Mindfulness of Death. And I'd like to suggest that each of us go to the website and read that short sutta and how contemplation of the of death. But he talked about it in terms of, he said, just as the elephant's footprint is the largest footprint of any animal, so too is the contemplation of death the greatest contemplation you can have, and changes everything. The realization of that changes everything if you're willing to go into it. And so he wasn't... He wasn't modest in how important he felt it was to start looking at our death and dying, the possibility of that. And we mostly keep it as a intellectual satisfaction, the knowledge of that we're going to die. But contemplation is really meant to bring it forth, to really to bring forth a realization. Some of you might have had that happen. If you hang around the subject long enough, it will happen. Where it's not something that's sort of arm's distance. Suddenly, perhaps very quickly, insightfully, you realize almost dramatically, my God, you know, I'm going to die. And it ceases being a subject matter of interest at that point. It becomes so startling and so dramatic in terms of its impact that most people have to step back from it, because it essentially questions our entire life. And this is, I think, what the Buddha was meaning when he was talking about how to use this subject in terms of its rightful orientation to our living experience, because we can't bring forth the subject without, when we hold up death to virtually any aspect of our life, we will see that aspect in light of the absence or the ending of it. And that's going to have an impact. That's going to have a tremendous impact on how we live. Now, we've just ended a series on time, and we talked about how time is carried in us. We carry time within us through our thinking, through our thoughts and ideations, and that we won't let ourselves end. We continue to perpetuate this sense of time in us, our thinking. Let's not make it too abstract. We continue to think purposefully for a reason other than the content of what that thought gives us. Because thought itself gives us a sense of continuity. It keeps us from ending. It keeps us from ending. So when we're talking about death, we can say we carry death with us by investing in our story, right? We seem to think that we can delay our death by continuing to talk to ourselves about our life. And if we ever stopped talking, something rather dramatic would seem to be happening here, because with the end of my story comes stillness, quiet, and that is where I'm not reaffirmed, and in fact where my ending is. So I perpetuate myself through my story, and my story, by its very nature, is a reaction to dying. And yet the fact that I compel myself to tell a story means that I will fear my ending. I will fear death. If I ever shut up and was quiet, if I ever allowed myself to cease the inward continuity of myself within myself, then I would face a very different dimension of the timeless. In fact, the series on time naturally pointed towards the timeless, that which was still. In the same way, this series on death will naturally point towards the deathless. Same ending point. Same ending point. But to survive, we continue to tell ourselves everything within ourselves. We give ourselves the whole reason and disposition of our life, the whole cause and purpose of our life, the whole sense of continuity within us. If we stop time, that is spiritual death. Stopping the internal, eternal noise making. So let me give you a prophecy. Between now and 2127, something catastrophic will happen. Where 6.5 billion people will die. That's a fact, because reaching out 120 years from today, which is the maximum lifespan of any one of us who is born, within 120 years, the entire population of the earth will cease. A catastrophic event, predictable within 120 years, in which every single person on the earth that lives here now will die. Now, if you go back to the year 50,000 BC, I don't know why I go back there, because it doesn't make sense to go back any further. There have been 106 billion people who have lived on this earth, and 100 billion of them have died. It is as predictable. It is as predictable as anything can be. Yet how many of us take that fact seriously? And how can we possibly have a spiritual practice without taking that fact seriously? Malarepa, who was a renowned Tibetan yogi, lived many, many years in a cave, and said, in brief, without being mindful of death, whatever Dharma practice you take up will be merely superficial. So that should show us something about the nature of our practice, shouldn't it? That should be a cold slap on the cheek for some of us. As if we could be actually practicing Dharma without considering the fact of our own ending. Because many of us, I think, within the comfortable lifestyles that we live, become inoculated within that comfort, within that pleasure. And we never push the envelope of the affluence that we live in. We never question it. We never see what's on the other side of that. We never ask pertinent questions of it, and we certainly hesitate to do that about our own bodily condition. And so that sense of continuity plays forth in our meditation. We sit and the sense of me continues right along, completely continuous, like a single note. We never question the continuity of that. And if we do so, it's only momentarily. But much more, we firmly embrace that continuity as the existence of our reality and the existence of the truth about me. That I existed yesterday, and by all likelihood, I will exist tomorrow. And our practice then is around that sense of continuity, that sense of continuous me. But the continuous sense of me isn't continuous at all. In fact, it's interrupted numerous times. It's like a dotted line. But we don't pay attention to the spaces between the dots because we only want the line. And so we blur it. We make it, it's anything that can is moved quickly enough beyond the present. That's why the present holds such reluctance to many of us, because there's a lot of blank spaces in the present. And we think if we can rush through the present, through our busyness, through our search of a better future, then we can step over the lily pond of the entrapped sense of stillnesses that are held within the present and speed our way right across into the future, where we are a continuous line. There's no question about it, as we are in our past. But the present isn't that way. The present holds no security of continuity. And it's therefore, as we approach the present, so too the subject of death and dying and ending also arises. And that, for most of us, scares us sufficiently so that we play a proximity role to the present. We don't really want to abide in the present because to abide in the present feels too tragic, feels too upsetting. We want to sort of have, we want to play around the edges of it a little bit. But the meditation inevitably, the practice inevitably has to bring us into a conscious awareness of our death and dying. Has to. We can't have a practice in which that doesn't come, a serious practice, in which that doesn't begin to arise. Now we can have a lot of self-improvement focus, a lot of sense of goals and efforts towards polishing the continuity of ourself. But that really isn't where the heart of the practice points, as I've pointed out many times. Here's a quote that I like. It's from, I know I mispronounce his name, but it's Maeterlinck, who's a Belgian playwright and poet. He said, "How could we possibly know the truth of death when we never look at it? If we look at it at all, it is when we are most feeble and disoriented. Death is the most luminous and perfect pursuit, yet we grant it not 1 hour of our intelligence." So this series is really to start bringing in the subject a little bit, start warming us to the proximity of that death. So the proximity of the death is really the proximity of the present. And so as we begin to take on the present, we become more alive because our aliveness is contained within the present. So death actually makes us more alive. It doesn't decapitate us. It doesn't foster a lack of aliveness. just the opposite. But most of us want to start this period of reflection in kind of remote terms. So let me start remote. I'm happy to do that with you. Let's just look at our life history for a moment and see where the close shaves, the car that almost hit us. I had that happen today on a bike. I was riding my this bicycle, and I was going parallel to a car who was turning right as I was going across the lane. And so I was speeding along on the sidewalk, crossing the street, and the car didn't notice me and just turned right in. And it was raining, and I wasn't hit or anything, but I just saw, you know, with a, is it maybe within a half a second of being hit? And how many times that happens in our life? How many really dramatic situations occur that we pass over and are blasé about because they represent something that we are mostly in denial of? It's the, how many of us noticed roadkill? That animal or cat, dog, who was alive a few moments ago and then the isn't. A few months ago, I put our cat out outside and she didn't come back. And, you know, it's like, whoa, there one moment and gone the next. It's just not there. But where? Where? The mind just wants to have an explanation for it. It wants to find out what happened. It wants to, but presence and absence, presence and absence. Ellen and I were a few years ago driving up from Tacoma, I think, and it was a beautiful sunny afternoon, and a couple on a motorcycle were driving relatively fast past us, and the reason we noticed them is because they looked so, oh, they were all dressed in white leather. And they looked like something from, I don't know, a rock band or something. You know, just, but almost too good to, you. Everyone noticed them. Hair, you know, streaming behind. And so we noticed them, and then they sped up ahead of us. So as we are approaching Seattle, as often happens, we were caught in a traffic jam, single lane. As we filed down through that single lane, we glanced over, and there were the couple laying very lifeless on I-5. Just one moment there, the next moment not. You know, as I mentioned, Kim Bush, very dear friend, was walking, hiking, and then lost his ability to speak. His wife sensed something was wrong. He had a stroke just that quickly, and helicoptered to Harborview, where he still lies in critical condition. And it's that one, the absolute uncertainty of the whole thing. See, that's why we so quickly deny that possibility. We haven't prepared for it. We haven't even allowed ourselves to consider the possibility of our ending. And we say it, we're so strongly continuous in our relationships, in our ideas, in our assumptions. I mean, what's the last thing we usually say to someone? See you soon, or see you again. Some way to bridge the separation that we feel with a sense of continuity that we want to be there. The problem is that denying death in such a way denies the Dharma. There's no other way to really say it. And when you deny death, we make the Dharma academic. It's like it becomes sort of an interesting subject to talk about. It's a lecture to attend. It's not something to really ingest or to consider the impact, the hardball of this thing. And it, I mean, life plays for a while it sort of, you know, tosses us very lightly into the stream of events. And then all of a sudden it brings out the paddle, starts whacking us in a way that was completely unexpected. And if it hasn't happened, and I'm sure it's happened in every one of our lives, do we think that was just circumstantial? You see? It's also circumstantial that you're living as well, or we're living as well as we are at the moment. That's circumstantial. What is our birthright health? Is our birthright affluence? Is our birthright complete mobility? I don't think so. And are the moments of disease and illness, are those the interruptions of our birthright? Or is the ups and down swings of life, the having and not having, is that what life is about? And we've just been on a very ambitious upswing, most of us, for a while. So when we deny death, we deny the Dharma, and we deny the truth of stillness. I think that's where it really gets under my skin. Because the whole of the Dharma is pointing towards the absence of things, the ephemeral quality of things, the changing nature of things, the have and have not, the presence and the absence. And noise to us represents life, but stillness and quiet represents death. We'll do anything not to have a moment filled with noise and intensity. Turning on the radio as soon as we get in the car. Epicurus, a Greek philosopher, said this. I like this. He said, "Why should I fear death? When I am, death is not. And when death is, I am not." That's the right way to use it. See, when I am, not who we think we are behind our labels and our images, but when I am quiet in myself, knowing the full embrace of my aliveness, then that is the deathless. Nothing can touch that. In fact, when people are dying, when I was at their bedside, I would often send them, regardless of what the circumstances were, they would come and go, both bodily concerns and all of the different comforts of body and discomforts of body during the course of an illness. But was there something that was untouched by that? Was there something, is there something in each one of us? Because that's where the Dharma points. It doesn't point at circumstances. It doesn't point at resting on the experiences of life as being the end point, the acclaimed point of the fruit of Dharma. And so we don't emphasize experiences. We don't encourage resting anywhere, because to rest anywhere, that rug is going to be pulled out from under us at some point. If not now, the next time you sit down. What is it that sees all of the situations of the comings and goings and ups and downs and swings? What is it that allows the capacity, what is it that gives the capacity of the mind to even know about those things? That is not influenced by experiences at all. And it's that to where the Dharma is pointing. So when we are not fully invested in finding and searching out the reality of our demise, of our death, of our impermanent quality and nature of ourselves, we deny the law of change. Nagarjuna, who is an Indian Buddhist philosopher of about the 10th century or something, he said, Life is so fragile, no more than a bubble blown to and fro by the wind. How astonishing to think that that after an out-breath there will be an in-breath, or that we will awaken after a night's sleep. How arrogant of us to believe that. In the proper relationship to death, it begins to correct our orientation to life. If we allow the possibility of death in, we also have to allow the possibility of how we're pursuing life to be exposed to death. And when we start looking at whether our need to reach and obtain is the right orientation to life, you have to ask it in relationship to your death. Because everything that you will obtain or have obtained, every relationship that you have or will have, will eventually end in separation. If that is true, then what is the true meaning of life if everything else is going to come and go as it will? I find that to be a very interesting line to hold ourselves in dharmically. Just to consider what you have, what we have, each of us have, what we hold on to be so endearing. And you can see that when we deny death, what comes out of us is a grasping or a fearing. Because either grasping or fearing, if we really look at it, is a fear of ending, of loss. I fear something so that I can protect it and keep it from being taken from me. I grasp at something in order to hold on to it longer than its natural duration, to encourage its life, to squeeze more life out of it. Both the desire and fear we have in life is a fear of death, of the fear of the loss of that thing. So when we take life in and say, okay, this is a fact, this is the fact of life, then we find ourselves releasing some of the grasping tendencies we have and some of the fear relationships we have. Most of us have to go through death taking us sort of to our brink, to the edge of ourself. And when it's first exposed to us, we get more fearful because we awaken to the fact that life is so ephemeral. We try to protect ourselves even more. We may stay in the house more, or we may call our loved one more frequently to make sure that they're okay. We may feel more controlling about our pets or our children. It brings a sense of protectiveness, of over-fear relationship to our relationships. And that is the mind being driven back to its brink, to its edge, in which those tactics have to be seen through or they begin to create a kind of insanity within us so that you never leave the house. Such a harsh sense of control within us that we're almost intolerable to be with. So we have to examine why it is that those qualities even come forth and whether they're in alignment and harmony with reality or whether they fight the reality, whether they are an attempt to forsake the reality that's here. And so any Dharma student has to look outside and inside oneself to see whether life is something that we can control, whether it's something that we can decide our own course through, whether we are in command here, any more than I was as I was riding across the street on the bike, in command of the car turning into me. We think we are, but to challenge ourselves in those points. Perhaps the most difficult area when we don't allow death into our life is in terms of access to our heart. When life is, when we want to affect life more than being affected by life, we lose our way within what life is really all about. When we try to challenge and create and determine life at every step of the way through our demands and our desires and our fears. We don't allow life to really touch us, to really affect us deeply, to let life in. In fact, we don't want to let life in, because when we do so, we have to admit its ephemeral quality, its impermanence, that it's in transition, and that we are not in control of the fact of how it will change and what it will do and what it will bring forth. And so to steer away from that, we try to affect life rather than to be affected by it. But the Dharma student, even in practice, what we try to do is to sit back and let the experience come to us. We're not there to try to turn the knobs of control, to try to bring forth any controlling response at all to our inward or outward experience, but rather to sit and really allow ourselves to feel what it's like to rest within life. And thereby, our heart begins to become tender. Our heart expresses itself with affection, with care. And it's the only way we can access the heart, is through that willingness to release the need to have it our way. So when we deny our dying, death, change, impermanence, we try to make our laws our own laws rather than the natural laws that hold death within it, the natural laws of change, the natural laws of life moving on its own. We try to make our God subject to the laws of the human mind. So we start talking about our God, our righteousness. Life doesn't contain righteousness. Nature, look at it. There's a righteousness within life. There's not even fairness within nature. But we try to impose those fair standards on life. We say, you know, that adults should die before their children, not the other way around, and that the kind of heart should have an easier life than the criminal. But that isn't the case in many situations. And every way that we try to impose our standards on life, life breaks it down if we just look beyond our own sphere, read the paper. So you begin to see that how we've organized mentally our life, it's to make it safe and on our own terms, because we're refusing to allow it to affect us, to really see what the issues are, what life holds for us, what life holds about us. We try to set our own standards and then have our God cooperate with those standards. We think of extended periods of time. We think of continuity, as I've mentioned. We also think in terms of quantity trumping quality. Measurements, results, and goals, especially in this culture, those are the things that really matter to us, aren't they? What we get out of it, the end product. And therefore, we never feel connected. We deny the very willingness to connect with life by trying to impose our standards upon life. What is life like when I live within its laws? When I don't try to assert my authority over it? Then we're on very fragile grounds, at least in terms of the assumptions we hold about ourselves and the meaning we have given to what life is. We begin to feel and see, when we allow death to come into view, when we allow ourselves to feel as fragile as we really are as human beings, suddenly the polar opposites of life begin to be reconciled. Death is not so separate from life. In fact, it comes together, as I mentioned, within this moment. In this moment is full aliveness, and in this moment death is. Because in order to be fully alive, we have to surrender what we think is our life. And so life and death, the polar opposites, begin to merge, begin to reconnect, begin to unite. It's not such a life of extremes or a life of such comparing opposites. I had a hospice friend I was working with, and she was in the hospital being diagnosed with end-stage lymphoma as the hospice staff was working with her husband, who was also dying. And so her life was completely falling apart. And I went to visit her in the hospital, having known her through her husband's hospice care. And when I went in there, I sat down with her, but the person I had known was not there. She had taken refuge far back into her mind, almost unapproachable. And I just sat there and I said to her, you know, Alice, I have no way of reaching you anymore. It feels like you've pulled so far back. I said, what could possibly still have any meaning for you now that you're dying and your husband is dying in front of your eyes? And she thought for a moment. She said, only two things. She says, my daughter is still worth living for, and my religion. And I stopped for a moment. I thought, you know, I wonder if there could have been any other situation that would have brought you that depth of understanding to your life, except the one that you're now in. In other words, the worst thing that could possibly happen to you has brought you to the deepest level of understanding, so that now you're seeing that life is about love for your daughter and for the caring affection that you have for her and your spiritual growth. And I remember you when you were the caregiver to your husband, and I remember how those words were never expressed. In fact, just the opposite. You were trying to encourage him and suggest that he wasn't going to die, if he could just make a determination that he wasn't going to die and stop giving in to death and all of that. And from that fighting point of view, I don't think you would have ever arrived at the depth of your understanding about life that you have now. Sometimes the worst tragedies, including the tragedy of death, is the very thing that access the wisdom that we could never have even approached in health. Because in health, none of us consider that. It's all going too well, isn't it? It's all too easy. It's all too easy. And unfortunately, some of us will die right from health, just like that. We'll have a heart attack, mass, and be dead. We'll have no time to really ingest the possibility of what a slow, tempered illness could do for our insight, for the way that we look upon the world. For I've seen enormous growth in hospice patients as they move through their dying in depth and understanding of their conditions of life and what they have used life to be. There's a beautiful Buddhist story of a woman who, most of you know this story, but just to review, a young mother who lost her child, a two-year-old child, I believe, and went all over India trying to find somebody to fix her child. And everyone, of course, said, well, your child is dead. There's nothing I can do. And finally, the mother, who refused to believe that her child was dead, was sent to the Buddha by some of these physicians. She comes to the Buddha and she says, will you heal my child? The Buddha said, yes, I'll heal your child. But you have to go to each household in the village and find me a mustard seed from a home in which that family has not experienced death. And then bring me back that mustard seed and I'll cure your child. And at that time, of course, each home household was an extended family. So the mother took her child, put her over him over her shoulder, went to each household and asked, knocked on each door and asked whether that household had experienced death. And people laughed at her and said, of course we've experienced death many times over. And on and on and on she went from one home to another until finally she realized that her child was dead. She went back, did a proper burial, and ordained as a nun in the Buddhist tradition. One of the hospice staff said to me, he said, you know, every day I have to wake up to the fact I'm going to die if I'm going to be effective in my job. May I say that every one of us have to wake up to that fact to be effective as a human being. So the subject is not a light one. But if we're willing to bring forth the courage to consider it, to live within it for these weeks together, I think you'll find it to be a tremendous healing one. Thank you all. Can we sit for a minute or two? As we sit, I usually like to suggest that how we sit be in accordance with the talk, that we allow ourselves not to feel our continuity. But where are there spaces in the noise? Where are there gaps to our continuity that we don't even register? We move through them so quickly. How much quietness do we really bring to our sitting? Or do we play out in terms of dialogue, investing ourselves not in the stillness before us, but moving with the noise from one conversation to the next? This is a practice that will challenge each one of us. Again and again, I will say, self-monitor. Okay, if there are any questions or comments from anyone, I would be happy to do my best. Is it about staying in disorientation longer and longer?
Can you talk about the fear that the sense of disorientation that comes with exploring?
The question is whether my talk tonight had to do with staying in the disorientation for periods of longer and longer time. There are phases, when we get involved in this subject, there are phases of growth that most of us go through. The first phase is a self-protective phase in which we draw back into ourselves. We get even harder in terms of our fear, and our fear response is especially if our circumstances are very good in the moment. For many of you, they are. And you get very protective. You want those situations to continue beyond. We get tighter around them, right? And then something will happen, and the tarot cards will not be in our favor. Situations will change. Relationships will end. Whatever happens. Illness will occur. And then you just through the willingness to observe life in all of its different formations without assuming so much personal control over what it is that's happening, you begin to relax a little within it. You stay afloat. Everybody here is still afloat in life. What is it that's kept you afloat has not been the circumstances. Something else, some buoyancy in us. And you put much more resolve into understanding that than in the circumstances. When we turn to that phase, we release the bitterness we have when circumstances don't go in accordance, the cynicism. And you come into much greater, deeper sense of joy. And I'll go through each one of these phases as this series. But when you're in the state, the first stage, which most of us are partially still within, the confusion is something you want to get over. It's something you want to get through. Confusion is not in accordance to what my life is about. My life is about the stability of knowledge, of knowing, of the certainty of having things in front of me. So my suggestion is that when there are those moments in which you have, in which you're out of control, and which life has pulled its rug out from under you, don't move through those too quickly. Give them a chance to really express so that you learn from them, so you learn about life through them, so that you don't try to get over them and find your keys and not feel what it's like to be upset, to be unsettled, right? The forgotten name, the lost way, all of those moments that we have throughout the day in which, you know, something is out of place. Don't move through those too quickly. We'll break through this fear constriction more quickly if we allow the learning to take place through those minor deaths, those little deaths that occur throughout the day. Yeah. Yes. Yes, that's very nice. She said when she was a little girl, she had the fear of going to sleep because she would be absent. Nobody would come back and, or would care that you were missing. Is that basically? Yeah. And that now she sees that the letting go has a beauty component to it. It doesn't feel like an abandonment. In fact, it's just the opposite, you see. It's the sense of the only way we're ever going to get connected is through our death. Not an objection to death. The more objective, more objection we have with death, the more isolated and cut off we will be. And the Dharma is about interconnectedness. So we have to go through that fear and that isolation to find the interconnection. It's always through that, never finding a journey that offsets it, right? And so if while we're meditating there are feelings of abandonment, we stay connected to that. We stay connected to everything. Nothing is allowed to disconnect us. And thereby, nothing is allowed to cut us off or to send us back or recoil us back into a sense of self-protection. Because all of that has to do with the fear of dying in relationship to what it is that we're feeling. So it's the willingness to open our hearts to what we're feeling, to interconnect. And interconnection sustains itself through what you find, the beauty you find within yourself through interconnection. Your heart comes out, as always saying. You find a different quality of yourself that never could be found when you were in that kind of isolated, protective mode. And you begin to like that part of yourself. So that encourages further interconnection, which means further understanding and opening to our death. And all of it just keeps going in that direction rather than the opposite, which is the way life has taken us. Yes?
I had a near-death experience a while ago. And after going through that, I don't have fear of dying like the boogeyman if it was at one time. So I'm wondering,
no, his question has to do with a near-death experience in which it has alleviated a lot of fear of dying and whether that was a good experience. It was a good experience in the fact that it made you less fearful of the physical death. But here's something that I would like to caution us about. You see, where heaven comes in, where all of the afterlife experiences come in, is the same thing that happens about, we don't know what, most of us don't know what happens at the moment of physical death. So we invest or invite a whole heaven or hell range of options. And then we say, that's what life is going to be. And so we really invest in the continuity of ourselves after life rather than the ending of ourselves at physical death. What we want to do in meditation is to allow the natural ending of ourself rather than constant continuity. You had an experience of an out-of-body where your physical body wasn't who you were, but you continued, maybe in personality or character or something. I'm looking for where the meditation is pointing is not inviting any continuity at all, allowing ourselves to stop fully here and now. Doesn't mean we become dysfunctional, as I've said many times. We become very functional. We get on the plane at times. We make our reservations. We keep our appointments. But that sense of needing ourselves to continue through life and afterlife is the very focus of which Dharma addresses. Okay? So out-of-body experiences can be helpful in one way and a disservice to the Dharma in another. So we have to stop now.